Well, here we are on the second Sunday of Lent. Millions of Americans every spring give up something for Lent. Maybe many of us here have done so. The church I grew up in didn't observe Lent back then. It does so today, and it's intriguing how many Protestant and independent churches and movements have adopted what was once considered a largely Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, and Anglican practice. And this is due generally to a striking upsurge in American spirituality to bring back practices, to have pragmatic things that enable the faith to have traction. We like to do things. Now, Swedenborg never mentions Lent. But this particular branch of Swedenborgianism adopted it a long time ago. You can turn to the page 216 and 217. Don't do it, but you could if you want. In the book of the 1950 book of worship, to see the cycle of the Christian year, and there you will find Lent. And its presence there is explained by the fact that early Swedenborgian ritual was drawn primarily from Anglican ritual. The word Lent comes from an old English word, lengthen, which evolved into lengthen and refers to the lengthening of days. The idea was that in the lengthening of days, where in its ripeness fall, Easter comes, there would be a preparation time for the dramatic conclusion, the dramatic power of teaching of Easter. And this practice of a preparation time dates all the way back to the 3rd century. But then it was only a few days. But it developed by the early Middle Ages into 40 days. That's the period that we have of Lent today. And it's been around a long time. So let's engage this idea of giving up something in preparation that's selected because it would create some difficulty for us, something that would cause us to notice that we're trying to keep our mind on a purpose, on a focus. I remember a friend's son gravely informing me years ago that he was giving up using his Sony PlayStation for Lent. I said, "That's going to be pretty tough for you." I had heard about his fondness for video games. "Not really," he said. "We also have Xbox." Giving up something in the way of food or drink is by far the most common Lenten practice. And I'm guilty as charged on that. This is about my 20th year of giving up sugar. But what if we thought about giving up something not temporarily, you know, in preparation for Lent, but what if we thought about giving up something permanently, something we would expunge from our lives entirely? And what if we thought about giving up not something physical, but something spiritual, something spiritually bad for us, something like jealousy or self-pity or apathy? Now we're talking about some serious self-improvement. What if we decided to really go large and give up lying? Good old number 8 on the tablet carried down from Sinai. It may not be an entirely unfamiliar effort to you to try to be aware of how truthful you can stay day in and day out, because anyone who has experimented with a conscious effort to track the tendency to fudge, you know, in our conversations knows how pervasive lying tends to be. Behavioral psychologists say that the average person evades full honesty several times a day. Leonard Sachs, who teaches psychology at Brandeis University, who's also an expert on polygraph testing, remarks that lying long ago became a part of everyday life. We could not get through the day without being deceptive. When I decided a week ago that I would take on this topic, and for myself, try to pay a special attention kind of every day to truthfulness and how lying or the tendency to fudge might come up normally in daily living, it was in less than an hour I found myself wrestling with a very difficult moral dilemma situation. If I don't lie about this certain matter, another person is going to experience great pain. So, in a bit, I'm going to have a caveat about situational ethics. Right? But for now, let me continue. Bella DiPaolo, she's a psychology researcher at the University of Virginia. She did this big study with 147 people between the ages of 18 and 71 who were to keep a diary of all the falsehoods that they told over the course of a week, to keep a detailed diary of every day. Most people, she found, lied once or twice a day in an obvious way. Both men and women lie in approximately a fifth of their social exchanges lasting 10 minutes or more. Over the course of a week, they deceive about 30% of those with whom they interact one-on-one, thus confirming Nietzsche's assertion that lying is fundamental to life. All for a good reason. Lying is a very important survival skill. We learn it right off the bat. We learn to ride this discovery that we come upon as a young child regularly to get us out of hot water. You know, small children, you don't teach your children to lie. What parent teaches their children to consciously be deceptive? But small children tell whoppers as soon as they can babble, right? One mother tells the story about her three-year-old who colored her face with a magic marker. And when her mother comes in and angrily freaks out without missing a beat, the tot plaintively protests, "She didn't do it." The magic marker floated up into the air and came at her and colored and decorated her face. Truly a magic marker. We can take this basic instinct to lie back even further than human toddlerhood. What about the renowned language-trained gorilla named Coco, who has learned a large number of hand signs from a modified version of American Sign Language? Coco knows about 1,000 signs, and she recognizes about 2,000 English words. And in her laboratory habitat, she has a computer whose keyboard has all these pictures on it, and she can construct basic sentences and hold conversations with the animal psychology trainer who has raised her, Penny Patterson. One time during the night, Coco tore the sink off the wall of her habitat. A pretty expensive little frivolous burning off of energy. And when Penny Patterson arrives and angrily confronts Coco, she darts to her computer to tap out that she had not done that terrible deed. It was the pet cat who also lives in the habitat. So the level of primate below our species has also figured out how useful lying is. Now, we will set aside for another discussion why it is sometimes wise to lie. In a moral reasoning class, we could have good, long, fruitful explorations of situational ethics. But situational ethics, when permitting a normally banned behavior, is always only justified when the good it delivers is for someone else, not for one's selfish gain. And I'm not talking about presidential primaries. Though, interestingly, Swedenborg in his several pages discussing the spiritual damage that occurs, you know, in lifestyles where lying just becomes routine and not reflected upon, that it becomes endemic in the political arenas too. Political activities where disparagement and slander of others is done to undermine their status, their name, and reputation. And I'm really glad nothing like that goes on in the United States. Swedenborg has a pretty famous discussion of the inner sense of each of the Ten Commandments. It's chapter 5 in his last great work, True Christianity, often considered his Summa, where he peels through the permeations and the layers of each of the behavioral commandments. And the main spiritual point Swedenborg wishes to make about number 8 is that how we feel about ourselves and about life is so much better when we become more conscious of our routine truth quotient. You see, lying is stressful. Even for people who get really good at it, it's stressful. Only when they actually believe the lie does it become unstressful, right? But and that's the definition of insanity for Swedenborg, when you actually believe that lies are truthful. But up to that point, one simply becomes skilled at camouflage, and it's not a restful place to be. Because that's what polygraph tests actually test. They test for stress. They're not lie detectors. They're freak-out detectors. We all know that tightening feeling, that anxiety, you know, when we start to depart off of what we know is true. Our feet start to leave the ground, and we're not firm in our foundation. Lying ruins our spiritual health. Oliver Wendell Holmes nailed it when he said, "Sin has many tools, but lying is the handle that fits them all." The goal of number 8 is a whole way of life. It's a whole way of being. A liberating and powerful way of being you and being me. It is about a deep love for the intrinsic beauty of truth, for what really is, for what is actual, and about a trust in being truthful as a channel toward wholeness and authentic goodness. That's the power of number 8. The truth really does set us free. So what would giving up lying for Lent actually mean? It entails becoming perceptive about our tendency to be deceptive. And when detecting that subtle stress factor that we are actually feeling, that we then take advantage of that now more conscious choice about whether to change our course or not. Until a person reaches a certain stage of inner awareness and spiritual clarity, we involve ourselves in all kinds of fuzzy falsehoods. It's the way of lower order survival. In Swedenborg's spiritual analysis of the 8th commandment, there's at least 4 levels or types of bearing false witness. How common it is to distort information or stories about another person due to our own agenda. That's a form of lying. What if we undertook the discipline to try to see the best qualities about a person whom we instinctively wish to disparage, who threatens us in some way? Another familiar form of lying is getting caught up in the myriad ways that we tend to speak with more authority on a subject than we actually have. Luckily, I never fall to that one. That's actually stressful when we do that, isn't it? We can feel ourselves kind of getting beyond our boundary of knowledge because we need to be seen as authoritative in that situation. But when we're strictly within our expertise, how solid we are. It's a matter of self-awareness. What about the innumerable instances when we try to make the truth fit our special interests? When we work so hard to rationalize and reconstruct what is there in order for it to fit inside of us in the right way. An even more subtle form of lying is falsely attributing our own inner states, our own emotional states, as the fault of somebody else, and not taking responsibility for ourselves. So giving up lying for Lent is a pretty big goal. But it is one that really should be a long-term goal, a permanent goal. There's a story that made the rounds about an 87-year-old woman named Rose, who was the country's oldest college student at the time, several years ago. She was asked to speak at a conference on lifespan psychology. And right when she stepped up to the podium in a packed auditorium to give her speech, the stack of 3x5 cards on which she had all of her notes squirted out of her hands and flew all over the stage around her. And she declared, "I knew I shouldn't have given up beer for Lent. The whiskey is killing me. I'll never get my speech back in order, so let me just tell you what I know." And she proceeded to talk about what it means to grow up. And that's different than growing old. Growing up is putting away the lower order survival mechanisms and developing ways to become grounded with greater courage and a higher order of love and truth and a desire to empower others. Everyone grows older, but not everyone grows up. Growing does take courage. C.S. Lewis once wisely pointed out that courage is not itself a virtue. It's the testing point of every virtue. Right? How often we instinctively prevaricate because we feel vulnerable, and we instinctively hide behind the gauze of a lie. But that's not living. That's not the kind of life the one who brought us into this life wants for us or that we should want for ourselves, the one who wanted to sanctify us in the truth. So we can turn to the Swedenborg quote that's in the program, but you don't need to do it right now because I'm read it for you, where he writes, "When a person abstains from false testimonies and turns away from them as sins, the love of truth and the love of justice flows in from the Lord through heaven. And as a consequence, a person's utterances become utterances of truth, and their works become works of justice." And that's no lie.